Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Coors Light. Made to chill.
We're talking football with a professor, John Clayton, as we do every single day. Hello, John.
Hello. I hope everybody had a good, safe weekend.
We all did. Hopefully everybody listening did as well. Hey, you were part of the voting committee for the All-Decade team. Did that turn out the way you thought it would?
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple of things that went a little different. The one thing we didn't know was how they were going to break it up, because we voted for over 100 players, and what we did, we had a first team. Like, for example, we had four quarterbacks, usually like four at a position, because then we're thinking, okay, so you're going to have, you know, three that'll come out as quarterbacks, but only two came out. So we didn't know they were going to take, you know, 53 and two coaches. We knew about the two coaches, all right? So that was a little bit different. But, you know, when I went up and down the list once we got it this morning, you know, I was about, oh, I'd say 92-93% accurate on the first on defense. Had a few that didn't go on offense. And again, you know, a few little twists and turns, but usually it turned out that if I didn't have a guy that did make it, then he was like third or fourth on the list. So I didn't miss on any of the big names. You know, like, for example, a little bit of a surprise that Cam Chancellor lost out to Eric Weddle, because I had Eric as a second teamer, and Cam was my fourth safety on the on that position. But overall, I mean, it turned out pretty good, because you got four Seahawk position players that made it: Marshawn Lynch on offense, Bobby Wagner, Earl Thomas, Richard Sherman, Pete Carroll, and I think all were justified. But you know, the one that kind of slipped through was that I didn't have Travis Kelce as my first teamer. I had him as a second teamer on the offensive line. There was a couple little shifts and all that stuff, but it kind of went the way I voted, and I feel kind of good about that.
Yeah. Hey, John, let me ask you about Drew Brees. How close was he there? Because I was just kind of looking. Hasn't been great in the playoffs, but you know, you look at like his quarterback rating and everything, was he in the mix there? I'm sure.
Yeah, I would venture to say third or fourth, because you know, when I look at the list and I can see, like, for example, you know, I did spend a lot of time on it because I wanted to make sure I did a good job for the people involved, and you know, that turned out well. But you know, like, for example, and again, that's why we didn't know how they were going to break this down. They didn't tell us, and so we didn't know if there's going to be two quarterbacks or three quarterbacks, if there's going to be four tackles, six linebackers, all that stuff. And so the breakdown we didn't do. But again, like, for example, my vote, and I guess most of the votes probably went this way, is that you're going to have Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, because they were the two elite quarterbacks through the entire decade. You know, Drew Brees, I think, probably finished third, and Russell Wilson finished fourth, because I know when I did my first team, you know, I had you know, Wilson in there on the first team. I had Brees on the first team. I had, obviously, Rodgers and Brady, because I know when I was, you know, doing all my elite quarterback stuff, it was always those two at the top. You know, the one that probably, you know, kind of slipped through the cracks was Ben Roethlisberger, because I've always had him, you know, right up there too. But then, you know, but overall, that went pretty well. I bet you he finished third.
John, I imagine that Bill Belichick was a runaway number one as top coach of the decade. But who gave Pete Carroll the biggest run for the second spot?
I say Andy Reid and Sean Payton. Both, I think, are all deserving, because I know they were my first ballot nominations as far as first teams, just because, you know, Andy, you know, all the playoffs he's been to in Kansas City and Philadelphia, Sean Payton for his offensive imagination and what he's been able to do through the years. So I would say those four, with a fifth being maybe John Harbaugh.
You guys can text in any questions you've got for the professor. 710-710 is our text line. We'll try to get to some of those before we wrap things up for the day. We also saw the news, and I don't know how big this news is, but they're going to conduct the draft still on time. They're going to do it. Everybody's going to be in their own quarters. You're not going to be at team facilities. You're not going to do any of that. Everybody will be. It'll be the virtual draft. How do you imagine that looks, John?
It's going to look very strange. I mean, because, you know, you see it now if you watch any TV, live TV, news shows and all that stuff. I mean, the pictures are all different, you know, with quality. There's a lot of breakups in the way it goes, a lot of connection issues. And so it's going to be tricky. And again, for a guy like John Snyder, I think he's going to be challenged more than most, because one of John's specialties is trying to, you know, contact teams with his staff and be able to, you know, make trades. Well, now, I mean, you now have 15 minutes in the first round, 10 minutes and 5 minutes to try to make all these deals. And how do you do it? Because, you know, how many phones can you have at your own place? Because one, you're going to have communication between Pete Carroll, you know, Scott Fitterman, you know, Trent all these different, Trent Kirshner has to be contacted. So how are you going to be able to do that? You know, because now you have all this going on. It's going to be basically John and an IT guy trying to make these arrangements, make the phone calls. I think that's going to be very difficult. But hey, you can understand that it's like you don't know how long this is going to go. So if you move it back, when do you move it back to? Because this still may not be cleared up by the end of May, and you might as well at least, you know, get the things done that you can get done. Make your draft choice selections, come back, get the guys signed, or get the agreements, and then, await when you get that first time to report. So I think it's the wise thing to do, but it's going to be tricky.
Yeah, do you think it's gonna that there's going to be a lot of problems that come out of this, John, at this and free agency, just because we've talked about the physicals, getting a last chance to talk to a kid, face-to-face. Do you anticipate that this is, maybe one that we'll be looking back on and go, oh, yeah, that was that 2020 draft where the coronavirus thing took over, and you – what do you think? You positive or negative?
Oh, yeah, because you're going to have more mistakes regardless in this draft than you have anything else because, can you imagine how tricky it's going to be to evaluate the players who didn't go to the combine? Because now, unless you're among the 12 teams or so at the beginning, that 12 schools that had workouts, you don't have any numbers for anybody. I think from the interview standpoint, I think you can come out of that okay, because now you can set up a video conference with that player. You can spend enough time to get a feel. So I think, technology helps you out on that part of it. And of course, if you're trying to do multiple guys at one time because they've got time commitment problems or whatever, that I think you can get that solved. Now, of course, you can see some agents are trying to set up so that you can see, some video workouts on the workouts. I mean, all those individual things. But, hey, again, you're going to have more mistakes in this draft than any else. And, again, the mistakes are going to be on character, and it's going to be mistakes on injuries. And also, I mean, you're going to really don't know what to do with some of the undrafted guys.
Well, John, is it going to hurt John Schneider more than other general managers just since he's known to trade as much as he does during the draft?
I think it will, but the one thing is the fact that he's been doing it for a long time, I think he can prepare well enough to, because, again, one of his specialties is that, he makes the draft day trades. All right, well, it's like you know if somebody's calling you what the offer is going to be, but if you're trying to call somebody else to move up, then that might be a little bit more difficult. But I think that, he's so good at it, and he can make fast decisions. I mean, you saw that last year, how he maneuvered, with the, Frank Clark trade, having to start with four draft choices, ending up with 11. Now, again, this is a staff thing, but you can have, different people make sure, like, for example, I mean, you can designate, Scott Fitterer, okay, you handle calls to these six teams, and, Trent, you handle the calls to these six teams, I'll handle these, so you can still try to work that out, and you have to just make sure you have the phone numbers, but boy, the communication back and forth is going to be very, very difficult.
Well, John, have they set it in stone that they're going to do the usual type draft with a 3-day draft? Because I heard Mike Salk talking about it today, where why not just have one round a day and extend it for 7 days? Adam Schefter proposed that idea a week or two ago. Any chance of that happening?
It may be the wiser idea, but I tend to think not, because I think that they, but honestly, I mean, what I think both are suggesting might be the right thing to do, because, now instead of compressing something into, one day and, the 10 and 5 minutes, because again, that's where the problem's going to be. I guess you can see it moving very quick, but it might just be from, to give teams a chance, to have a little bit more time to be able to work on things. So like, you take the 10 minutes and you make it 15, and you take the 5 minutes and you make it 15, and you can do that over a 7-day period. Of course, I mean, the only thing that's going to end up happening is that by the end of the 7th day, I mean, you may have to put all the general managers on a cot, because they're going to be absolutely, totally, mentally, and physically worn out.
The professor, John Clayton, is with us, as he is every single day. Again, you can text in any questions you've got to 710-710. We'll try to get to some of those John, I see that Antonio Brown not only has a new agent representing him, a guy from EMG Sports, but also the state of Florida has levied three formal charges against Brown for an alleged January assault that resulted in his arrest. So he's facing felony burglar conveyance, misdemeanor battery, and misdemeanor criminal mischief charges. So I guess good news and bad news for him at the same time.
Yeah, I guess you can say that he has to hire two different people because now he has his new agent replacing Drew Rosenhaus and his new personal attorney who represents him in court and try to get him off of this. And this is one that is going to be very difficult because, you know, you can see that, there was physical altercation there that he was involved with. There was physical damage to the truck. And, I don't know what people are going to be able to testify or do anything else like that because I don't know where the evidence is. But, it's just another thing that goes against him and is going to limit his chances to get back in this league. Because remember, the league has still not ruled on whether he is going to be suspended. I mean, they're still investigating. And now this investigation has the fact that there is a formal charge against him, along with some of the other stuff that's happened to him. I still think he's in a very tough spot, and I really question the chances of him getting back in the National Football League.
How different would your opinion be?
And by the way, sorry to interrupt, but it's like, you did see he did go all decade, and deservedly so.
If he were 26, 27 even at this point, how different would your opinion be of his future? Because you're talking about a guy who's in his 30s now, and then you throw in everything he's been, good and bad, on the field, off the field, that makes him unappealing. But how much of that is his age?
And to some degree, but I mean, and again, say what we want about these incidents. I mean, certainly they're not as bad as Greg Hardy, who was around 26 or 27, and he never really got a chance to get back into the NFL. And so, Hardy was in a tougher spot. But the thing is, these number of things, the blow-ups and everything else, it certainly puts him in a very bad spot. But, yeah, I mean, the youth, if he was 26, may have helped him out a little bit because you realize, things down the line. Like, for example, in Josh Gordon, who's, his incidents are all just substance in that, and PED. Is that he keeps on, but he's young enough that you can still see him coming back. But overall, I mean, yeah, youth would help him out. But again, his number of incidents are getting so strong, particularly, with women and all that stuff. Not like Greg Hardy, because again, Greg Hardy was around that age, and he never got a chance to get back.
Well, he got back.
All right, John, we're that's right. Yeah. All right. Hey, John, we're doing kind of a fun thing. Brent Stecker had an idea of, what's your favorite sports movie, things like that. And I'll get to that. But John, who is somebody that you look back on in your career that really helped you out, that you look back fondly, that whether it was chemistry you had with them or something that they did for you to help you in your career when you were younger?
Oh, there's so many that, I could probably fill up two segments, with introductory ones. It was funny because I was talking to an agent today who called just to check on me. And you'll appreciate this, Dave, because I learned so much from your agent, Marvin Demoff. I mean, he taught me the negotiating styles. He taught me, how to work the salary cap. He taught me all those different things. And so, I have to put him right toward the top. When you're cutting your teeth, on a Steeler team that was one of the greatest all time, and you're getting help from Jack Ham, you're getting help from L.C. Greenwood, you have the endorsement of Terry Bradshaw. It was like I have to thank them so much. Dan Rooney, how open he was for allowing a 17-year-old kid at Churchill High School to have a press pass for the entire season and sit there and watch the Immaculate Reception. I learned so much from him. Certainly the salary cap stuff, I mean, I can't name them because they've helped me out so much, but I've learned so much from them. There are so many people to thank through the years that it would be an endless list, but that's just a start. But right toward the top is your former agent, Marvin Demoff.
Yeah. Nice. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, Marvin did a great job. And his son, Kevin, now is the COO of the Rams. I don't know if you saw this. He went on Twitter and I guess people were doing like mean tweets or mean texts about the new logo. And so, and he said, hey, look, man, we're sticking with this. But if you check that out, I think it's on NFL.com. But he basically is responding to a lot of these mean texts that are, it's pretty funny. And, you know, they're sticking with that logo down there, John, even though a lot of people are complaining about it.
And again, it's like I can't repeat this on the air, but you know the description that Eric Dickerson has about the logo, and it's a kind of a pointed one, which I will not repeat. But yeah, it doesn't look good, but hey, they're sticking with it, just like they're sticking with the plan that they have that's now cost them five key guys on defense and Todd Gurley.
Well, John, since we're talking about the Rams, I figured it'd be nice if we mentioned Johnny Hecker making the all-decade team as the punter. Was that a tough decision for you guys? You had Shane Leckler as the other punter, too.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the multiple Pro Bowls, the yardage, the average that he's had, the athletic ability, the special teams. Because, again, I mean, he probably did, you know, more fake plays and more trick plays than any other punter I've ever seen. So no, that was an easy one. It's great that he grew up in the area. What's appreciative is that you go into the locker room and he's one of the first people to come over to somebody like me and, you know, talk to me, talk about the family, his family and all that stuff. So no, I think that was one of the easiest ones. I mean, certainly, you know, Brady Rogers was easy. You know, the running back stuff was pretty easy. You know, some of the offensive linemen was easy. You know, the four Seahawks was easy, but Hecker, no, he's certainly. But I mean, and that's pretty interesting because again, you have Hecker and you have Justin Tucker, and those two guys, you know, they were the best of that decade.
John, the 509 said, "I hope that you guys are staying safe and healthy." Clowney has said that all things being equal, he would choose Seattle. Has he gotten better offers elsewhere? If so, where? And if not, what's the holdup?
Okay, going through some of the things that we've seen over the last couple of days, and I know that on my show I'm spending a lot of time on it. Tomorrow, for example, we're going to talk to Mary Kay Cabot of the covers for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. You know, today we talked to Jeremy Fowler, who brought up, you know, the idea that the Cleveland Browns were involved and has broken several stories on Clowney. But the Jets, they're out of the picture. Never really were in it. You know, the Jets took the position that they weren't going to spend as much big time in free agency. So George Fant was their highest paid offer that they made at $9.1 million. So they weren't going to go to $14 to $16 million. That wasn't going to happen. Tennessee, yeah, they are interested. But the question is going to be, if you give him a one-year $17 million deal, you now have $30 million of your cap tied up in the offense outside linebacker because they have $13 million tied up on one-year deals with Vic Beasley and Korea, so I can't see that being happening. Cleveland could be interesting. Now, the question is, you know, and there's several questions, you know, they've got $43 million of cap room. They have the room to be able to do it. You know, his agent is Myles Garrett agents, and he's their best defensive player, so you can see that having but the problem is, can they get him in for a physical? And that's where I think the big issue is. Do something, you know, they'll have to cut Olivier Vernon, who is probably making too much because he didn't fit into the defense as well as he did down in Miami, you know, and even as well as he did with the New York Giants. So that could be one. But I think right now it's Cleveland, but if they make him an offer, you know, even if it's a good offer, they can't give him a physical. And so if you can't get the physical, then how can you really do it? Because, again, you know, they can agree on something. They can put the paper, like Todd Gurley put in his paperwork today, and so he goes on the books on the salary cap. But, hey, they could take Atlanta, take him and go to the, you know, the first day of training camp and then fail him on the physical when he gets nothing.
Yeah. Well, John, you've been critical of the Cleveland Browns, and rightly so. But do you think, let's say they do get Clowney. Are they on the path, do you think, that they can actually be good? Are they not going to be the punchline this year, do you think?
No. Andrew Berry, their general manager, I really respected. I respected him, you know, when he's working in several different places. And so even when he was working in Cleveland under that disaster, I think he's one of the bright young general managers and one of the bright young guys in this league. And so when I did my grades for the Washington Post for free agency and the off season, I gave like six AFC teams A grades, but I gave Cleveland an, a B-plus grade. And the only reason I gave them a B-plus grade is that they had to sacrifice two linebackers on defense and really not replace them with real starters because, you know, Joe Sherbert ended up almost getting $6 million a year to go to Jacksonville. Christian Kirksey was cut and went to Green Bay. So on a 4-3 defense, to overturn 66% of your linebacking core, that's tough. But, you know, to make the moves that they did with the eight players that they've been able to bring in, I think they've done a really good job. And so I think it's a B-plus deservingly. Now it's a matter if they can, you know, add to the draft and do well in there, you know, they can really get over the top.
All right, Professor, there's some betting odds that are set on the draft by betonline.ag. Who will the number one pick hug first? Mom, dad, girlfriend, friend, or sibling? And mom is the favorite, Professor.
Yeah, I would have to say mom always going to be the favorite. That's going to be the one. Now, the question is going to be, you know, how many people are going to be allowed to be in the house? You know, because that has to be kind of monitored. But you'd have to figure, because the one thing, particularly now, you know, and again, it's nice to be able to celebrate what's going to be the greatest moment of a player's career. But also, you can't jeopardize things right now. That's being selfish. And so, you know, the question is going to be, how many people are going to be in the house where he's going to be, you know, connected and all that stuff? And so you hope you eliminate it just to the immediate family and not have friends over and not do that. That, I think, would be wrong. And I hope that, you know, Roger Goodell reminds everybody of that because, you know, we still have to watch. Because, again, you're not having social distancing if you're having 25 people in the house having a little party celebrating, you know, what's a great moment. So I hope it's just family, and I hope it's the mom.
And the second question, John, in the first round, betonline.ag, you can actually wager on this. How many dogs will be shown in the background of these players that are picked? The over-under is 3.5, Professor.
You're talking about dogs as far as draft choices or dogs as far as animals?
No, John, dogs in the background.
Oh, you have to take the over. I don't know because I mean, it's like it's now to the point with so many people home, and I think this is great because I know, you know, particularly every day I show doggy pictures, you know, videos to my wife that are so cute. Like it was one yesterday of a dog that is a volleyball player, and the dog, you know, was putting the ball up. So his teammate could, his owner could, you know, swipe the ball over against the two girls they were playing against. And so it's like, you know, those things are great. No, you got to go with the over in that. And, you know, going through Twitter as much as I do, like every 15 Twitter things, you have pretty much some dog picture. In fact, you know, I think Taylor Jacobs probably leads Twitter in dog pictures. Taylor, of course, worked here at our station.
I used to show those to Dave. I think he really misses when I do that for him, but we'll resume.
I think Bob probably leads the league as far as showing dog videos. I think Bob is definitely.
Well, of course, I mean, the one thing is, you know, bring up the Cleveland Browns, and, you know, right now everything's on replay, is that maybe what they can do is go through the years and show how many dog draft choices they've had, which you have to take the over.
That would take the entire off season, which will be the entire season in front of us, John. That's too many to count.
Johnny Manziel.
Hey, quickly, oh well, geez, you can go with Brandon Whedon. You could go with Tim Couch. We could go up and down. It's just a Brady Quinn. It's just a collection of failure. Quickly before we hit the break, John, Tua Tagovailoa. I saw Rex Ryan talking about him today, saying he's the biggest risk in NFL history, and this is based on the number. You know, we've heard he's had three surgeries. Rex Ryan says, well, I've heard he's had five. And when in a year like this, when you really don't have the opportunity to examine these guys physically the way you otherwise would, he says that's the biggest gamble in NFL draft history. Do you agree with that?
I wouldn't say it's the biggest gamble in NFL draft history. I mean, certainly I think Johnny Manziel would hit that category, but I think that, you know, it is very much a big gamble because you don't know. Now, the good news is he did come out and get a good review from the Tennessee Titans doctor who did the physical on him in Indianapolis, which was sent to all 32 teams. So he got a reasonably clean bill of health there. So that's encouraging. But yeah, you're right. And now in some circles, but of course, the one thing you have to remember, we're now in that couple weeks. Week window where everybody tries to talk everybody down. And so sometimes you can't buy the negative talk out there because, you know, you may have people who are Justin Herbert representatives trying to get the word out. Oh, yeah, Tua, I talked to three teams, and, you know, they've taken him off the board and all that stuff. And then I know now we're getting the Jordan Love going over Justin Herbert. I mean, some of that stuff you just have to ignore. But, no, I think it's a factor, and it very well could affect him. Still think he's going to go to Miami, but I can't guarantee it.
John, we appreciate it. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Okay, that sounds good.
There you go. The Professor John Clayton with us every day. If you missed any of today's cold, hard facts, brought to you by Coors Light, made to chill, just download the podcast at 710sports.com. Jeremy Fowler says a team came very, very close to signing Jadeveon Clowney last week, and it was not the Seahawks. We'll hear more about that coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It is powered by Dubin Law Group. It is free. If you don't have it, you should get it because you can listen to us every single day. You can get the podcast. You can get everything you would otherwise have right there. And again, at the right price, it's free. Coming up at 5 o'clock, our buddy Big Ray Roberts, part of the Seahawks pregame, halftime, and postgame show, will join us. Talk some O-line, see what he thinks of the acquisitions they've made on the offensive line. But Jeremy Fowler was a guest of the professor this morning talking about the latest on Jadeveon Clowney. And cut number one, Fowler says the Browns, of all teams, were very close to signing Clowney last week.
I believe as of like last Sunday, not yesterday, but the week before, that a lot of people around the league thought that they were very close to getting something done. It just didn't happen for whatever reason.
Now, Jim, you wrote about this, I don't know, was it last week or the week before? You brought up the Browns as a team that could be interested in them. I don't recall what John Clayton's response was to that, but I'm surprised you didn't demand an applause, a round of applause, do a victory lap of some sort in front of John. What happened there?
Well, part of it is the delay, and I didn't want to interrupt anybody. And then part of it is me just being humble. No, I actually, I just out of a process of elimination, when I wrote something about Clowney and possible destination spots for him, and I listed eight different teams, and I had him going to Cleveland number one. And I wish I could tell you that I had a source that told me the Browns are really interested, and but I don't. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't have that. I just based it on the fact that, boy, Myles Garrett is there. They're talking about, I remember Clayton saying something about Olivier Vernon, how they maybe aren't that happy with him there, and he might be a salary cap casualty. They could use that money to go after Clowney, and they wouldn't even need that money anyway because at the time when I wrote the story anyway, they had $42 million in cap space, which was number one in the NFL, and so I thought, well, okay, if there's a team that's looking for Clowney, they've got plenty of room to sign him. So it just, I don't know, it was just kind of power of deduction or whatever you call it that the Browns, I figured, would enter the fray at some point. And the downside being that they're a 3-4 defense, so heaven forbid that they'd ever have a shot at Clowney with a 3-4 defense. But here they are. It seems like they are at least interested.
Dave, what do you think of Jim poo-pooing the 3-4-4-3 preference for players?
It's just, I can only explain it so many times. that outside linebackers get paid less than defensive ends. And Cleveland runs a 4-3, from what I understand. So.
Oh, do they? Well, maybe I'm wrong about that then.
Well, they might have changed. I know they did last year, but we'll see. They got a new head coach there, Kevin Stefanski, and they had Jim Bob Cooter, or the equivalent of that, Freddie Kitchens last year, and he was a terrible coach. And I don't know, you know, I think the one thing that might be attractive there is that Clowney could probably get a longer deal there, but yeah, it's
Well, I'll let you play the sound on it, Bob, because Fowler said something about teams sending messages, and we talked about that with the Seahawks, you know, with Benson Mayoa, that maybe that was like, hey, man, we're to a point where we're executing plan B. Plan A was sign you for this amount. He didn't want it, so now we're executing plan B.
Yeah, cut number four. Again, Jeremy Fowler on with John Clayton this morning. Cut number four. Every team interested in Clowney has signed a pass rusher to send a message, he says.
You look at a lot of these teams have gone the route of getting, like, the backup slash bridge starter pass rusher in part, I bet, to send a message. You have Adrian Claiborne in Cleveland. You have Correa in Tennessee. And so, you know, Seattle signed Benson Mayoa. So, you know, you have a guy you can start, and he can get you some sacks and spot duty. So that, in part, it's like, hey, we can roll with what we have. You know, we don't need to give you $18 million a year. Now, granted, if the price is right, they would love to have him.
Yeah, I got to tell you, guys, and Dave, I'll start with you. The idea of a team sending a message with a signing, we're going to sign this guy so that this other guy gets what we're trying to tell him. That makes no sense to me. These are plan B. This is okay. This is in limbo. This is up in the air. We don't know what's going on with them. We've got to address our need, so we're going to address our need. The idea that there's some sort of concerted effort to send messages to guys, I just don't buy that.
Yeah, maybe it's just the semantics of that. I mean, I think what it says is that, hey, we're not coming down off the price that we offered you. And if that's the message that's sent, then I don't think they're doing it collectively or anything like that. It's just that, well, shoot, you know, this is and again, you know, we all see, well, except for Jim, we all see how good Clowney is. And and yet he's not getting the top dollar offer. So and again, I'll go back to, I've said this a million times. I think it's got to be his health. But yeah, I mean, I think they're just kind of saying, look, here's our offer for you, and it's not going to change, so don't come back, and, you know, this is our bottom line.
Well, good news for Jim here.
Okay.
Jim, cut number two. Fowler said things are quiet between the Browns and Clowney right now, but could heat back up soon.
I think things are actually a little dormant right now because they heated up, and then nothing got done. So they can revisit, but as far as I know, they've tried, and right now, you know, they got close, but nothing happened. So I think it's one of those things where it's either going to be Jadeveon Clowney or Olivier Vernon, who's already on the roster, starting a pass rusher for them, and they're just going to see how this plays out.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what the Browns are going to do. The Seahawks are waiting for it to play out, too. And, you know, I heard Danny on with Tom, Jake, and Stacy today and talking about it, and Danny makes the same point that I've tried to make, too, is that the Seahawks were the 26th-ranked defense with Jadeveon Clowney as part of that defense. And I understand that he's a terrific player, but I would say that, okay, this isn't going to happen, but here's what I would say. And you know I'm a betting man, so you know I'd bet on it. I put my money where my big mouth is anyway. Let's say they don't get Griffin, they don't get Matthews, they don't sign Bennett, they just go with Mayoa, Irvin, and what they have on hand. Maybe Shaquem Griffin will give them a lift, and we've talked about Rasheem Green and possibly LJ Collier. I would bet right now, and we won't see it because we know they're going to add somebody, either a Griffin or somebody in the draft, but I would bet right now that they're going to have more than 28 sacks next year without Jadeveon Clowney. I say that because I think Dunbar is going to help that secondary, and with an improved secondary, wait a minute, I'm making a great point here, don't laugh at it. With an improved secondary, that pass rush is going to get to the quarterback more often than it did this past year, and I know I'm damn right about that.
Wow, you're really going out on a limb. They had the second least sacks, and the least sacks they've ever had as a franchise. Maybe one. Maybe there was one year where they had 27, and you're saying they're going to get more sacks. That is bold. That is a bold statement, my man.
Or a
dumb
one.
I'm saying even without Clowney and even if they don't get Griffin.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll hold you to that. Well, I agree with you in that I don't think they're just going to settle on what they have and say, oh, we don't need Clowney, we don't need Griffin, we'll just go with what we got. There'll be another addition, which will make your point moot because it won't be the same group of guys that you just made that statement about. But coming up,
that's true, Bob.
Rams fans are not fans of the new logo, yet the I will say this. I give credit to their management and front office for having a sense of humor about it. We'll talk more about that when we sweep the dial next with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore. Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Coming back inside, full. Whoops. Clear.
Come on, Clint! Oh. God!
He's still down there. Still there. Yep, he just came up and wrecked the hell out of you again on purpose.
Y'all have a good one. That's it. That's why I don't take this serious.
Sorry, Tyler. I'm trying to talk to you there.
Peace out!
So I guess that's audio of NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace, who threw a bit of a tantrum and he quit a virtual iRacing event on Sunday. And then in turn, he lost a real life sponsor because of it. One of Wallace's sponsors, Blue Emu, I guess it is, didn't appreciate the attitude. So I guess he took to Twitter and laughed about how upset everybody was with him. So they decided to pull their sponsorship. And they've sponsored his real-life racing team and just recently signed a multi-year deal to become an official partner of NASCAR. So that could be a big deal, but they didn't appreciate the tantrum.
Well, it's about your character, too, right? And that's kind of what the Seahawks are trying to figure out with some of these players that they're getting. And so, he kind of screwed himself there. You got to be careful what you put out there, especially when you're representing. What is Blue Emu, by the way? Anybody?
I don't know. I know I've heard the commercials many times. I couldn't tell you exactly what it is.
I think I looked it up. It's some sort of ointment. I'm not sure. Do you think Blue Emu or Emu, whatever, do you think they overreacted a little bit, though? I mean, it was just a video game that he was playing, and I wonder what caused them to react the way they did. And I suppose you could say, hey, the driver shouldn't have done that, but at the same time, he was just playing a game. So if he quit, so what? Why would that cause his sponsor to pull the plug on him?
There's a Rams logo. What is it between? Trash and hot garbage. If you're low on toilet paper, don't worry. You can now get it on NFL Shop. Hashtag Rams. It's a little bit more expensive, regular trash. The new LA logo definitely appeals to the younger generation, since it looks like an effing Tide Pod. Rams fans, 2020 can't get any worse. Rams, hold my beer. Please make sure it's a Corona. This is actually embarrassing. Looks like some freshman college student in graphic design 101 made it in about 6 minutes.
That's the voice of Rams COO Kevin Demoff, who pledged to read the top mean tweets about the new Rams logo if $2 million were raised during the team's virtual telethon held with ABC7 on March 24th, and he had to live up to the promise because the goal was met. So this has not been a popular choice. In fact, I have yet to see anybody, whether it's on Twitter or in articles or just anybody weighing in on this logo, I haven't seen anybody that likes it. It's a terrible logo. I'd be curious to hear what the players truly think of it.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I played a game of horse with Kevin Demoff when he was like 8 years old, because I stayed at his dad's house when I got surgery down in L.A., but he's doing a pretty good job there. That's how you take something like that on. The new one with the ram head and the horns, I think is cool. I like that one. The one that has the L and the A, and then there's kind of that swipe that's going around it, that one's kind of lame. But the one with the ram head, I think, is pretty cool looking.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty cool what Kevin Demoff did, though. And he understood what kind of reaction he was getting out there and ended up getting $2 million raised for charity. So I think it's great that he came out with the mean tweets and read them. And I think it's going to end up being one of those things where it's being talked about so much that they're probably going to, the Rams are going to lead in merchandise sales at some point. But the question I have, Dave, did you beat that kid in horse?
Yeah, of course I did. But, you know, I was probably letting him win or something. But I also had a bad shoulder, Jim, so maybe he did take me down as an 8-year-old.
Sit down. Chris Emery, good to have you on the show. You know what? You know, you've been calling me that for about the last 5 years. About 2 years, actually, Chris. Well, somewhere along the way, Jim, you ceased being Jim and you became Chris. So let me tell you a secret. But, you know, we're sitting here right now, and if you guys want to take a station break, you can. But if you call me Chris Emery to my face one more time.
I already did twice.
You better, one more time, we better take a station break.
Well, it's a 5-minute segment. A 5-segment show. We got a long way to go.
Yeah, we do.
We got a long way to go.
We do.
I get a couple segments out of
it. Well, I'd love to be here with you, though.
Well, it's good to see you, too.
We've been talking like this behind my back for a long time.
But now I said it right here.
Right.
Exactly. Well, we got no problem.
Well, I think that you probably won't say it again.
I bet I do.
Okay.
Chris?
You could argue that's what made Jim Rome famous, was that incident. It was, I don't know how you guys felt about it. I thought Everett's attempt was pretty lame. You could see there was no intent for him to harm him in any way. And Jim Rome is Jim Rome, man. I don't know. You're a fan. I've never understood the appeal of Jim Rome, but you could argue that's what sort of catapulted him into the superstardom.
What I liked about that was that he put him to the test, because he said, I'll bet you don't say that again. And he was real brave and running his mouth. And then the second that it got physical, all of a sudden you could see Jim Rome kind of panic. And then his true self, his true colors kind of came through, which was, I guess if I'd put one word, it would be cowardice. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. But now I actually like Jim Rome. I've watched his show. I think he does a good job. But that was cheesy, the way where he goes, I bet I do, Chris. You know, I just thought, oh man, this guy totally deserves it. And I think I'm trying to remember how it went down. Didn't he shove the table and the table knocked him off of his chair?
It was pretty weak. You're right, he looked petrified, like, oh man, this is happening. And Everett looked like, well, I guess I got to do something, but I don't really want to do anything. So there was reluctance on both sides.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly why he was calling him Chris Everett. They spelled it differently, but soft, is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah, well, that he was playing. He used to be Jim Everett, but now he's Chris Everett, and it was his sexist way of calling him soft.
Okay. Well, it was an entertaining exchange, and as I recall, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong here, I thought Jim Everett was a pretty good quarterback.
Yeah. Well, he was. You know, the only thing I can ever remember about him is that my freshman year at Stanford, we went and opened up in Purdue, and I got some mop-up minutes at the end because I had a senior starting in front of me, and Jim Everett, or Chris, I should say, threw me a pick six, threw it to me, like right on the 5-yard line. I could have walked in, and it clanged off of my hands like my hands were frying pans. But no, Jim Everett had a decent career. I mean, he was one of the better quarterbacks for a pretty good time in the league.
Yeah, he and Flipper Anderson were quite a combo, I believe, for a stretch there. They were putting up some big numbers. I don't recall what was going on. I mean, that was a long time ago. I don't remember if that was his reputation around the league, that he would fold under pressure, or if he was thought of as soft. But, I mean, you could argue that's what made Jim Rome a household name, because I'm not sure how many people knew who he was prior to that interview.
He threw for 35,000 yards, yeah, mostly with the Rams.
Yeah. Exactly. I was looking that same thing up. 203 touchdowns, 175 interceptions. That's back when the ratios were a lot more more towards interceptions. But I want to say at that point, that was like 1992, 93 maybe, and he was still with the Rams, and that's when that whole incident went down. I just remember it being a really big deal. And at the time, I was a player, and so I thought it was kind of funny because I'd had journalists asked me punk questions before, and I was like, yeah, this is kind of a nice little, you know, holding the guy accountable. I thought was funny. I think everybody in the NFL liked it.
All right, coming up, our buddy Ray Roberts has been studying up on the Seahawks' newest O-line additions. He's ready to give us his assessment of what they've done. That's coming up next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.